Chapter 14. The First Don't. When CEO Tim Cook and his gurus were deciding where to situate Apple Inc.'s largest R&D facility outside the United States, they had few limits. The company's annual net profits were around $40 billion a year and climbing, as was the global market share of its mobile phone. Cook and company had the planet to choose from, and they picked a mid-sized suburb pinched between sea and desert, 7,500 miles from their headquarters in Cupertino, California, in a country with less than 9 million inhabitants and a gross domestic product in the vicinity of Norway's and Nigeria's. Apple erected a gleaming 21st century glass box of an eco-friendly building in that faraway spot and reserved 180,000 square feet of office space for 700 of its employees, with room to grow. The talk in that building and beyond was that this new facility would be the launchpad for future versions of Apple's signature product, the iPhone. If anybody at Apple had an inkling that a few dozen NSO cyber researchers right around the corner from the new digs were spending their days and nights hunting for weaknesses to exploit in the iPhone operating software, they didn't show it. NSO was barely known at the time and not really on Apple's threat radar, so the relatively small spyware company's presence certainly didn't shake the conviction that the business district of Herzliya, just north of Tel Aviv, was the place to be. "Apple is in Israel," Tim Cook said on his visit to inaugurate the new R&D center in February 2015, "because the engineering talent here is incredible." Talent in Herzliya was hard to miss. An air of ambition and confidence permeated the restaurants and bars, catering to the thousands of cybersecurity specialists and coders and software engineers working at dozens of neighborhood tech firms. The talk at table was often loud and learned and argumentative, whether debating the merits of the latest dating app or the latest job listings, must possess a deep knowledge of radical Islam, or the latest elections. This cohort was among the brightest 1% in Israel. The government had the test scores to prove it, working in the most lucrative and most glamorous field in the country. These young men and women were, quite literally, the chosen people, identified as school children, as possessors of uncommon intelligence, then encouraged to pursue math, physics, and computer science, and to prepare for their extraordinary personal destinies. The way Europeans seek talent and cultivate skills on the soccer pitch, and Americans seek talent and cultivate skills on the basketball court, Israelis spend their time and energy creating the magicians of cyber. The best of the best, known as Rosh Gadol, or Big Brains, are filtered at age 17 or 18 and slotted into the Israeli Army's cyber intelligence units, where they can do their mandatory military service at a reasonable bodily remove from the dangers of combat. When the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, really wants to get someone, they might send officers to speak to this young person's parents, convincing them it's best for their son or daughter to go and study, and this will give them the best start for their life, says one of the Rosh Gadol. That's like the common thing around here. Every Jewish mother wants their son to be a tech engineer these days, not a doctor. Doctor is second place. The IDF demands a longer term of service for its cyber warriors, but offers in return a combination of training, coursework, real-world experience, and affirmation. "Anything is possible," was the message members of this elite unit got from their commanders. "You can open any door if you just put your mind to it." The thousand or so Rosh Gadol who finish their service and enter the private sector each year walk away with instant connection to high-paying, high-tech jobs. They often follow their ex-team leaders into new startup tech companies, lured in part by the very real possibility that they are in on the next big thing. Evidence abounded by 2015. There was plenty of talk in Herzliya and other high-tech hotbeds in Israel about startling new deals for companies led by former IDF cyber specialists. An Israeli tech startup reportedly sold to Oracle for $50 million, another to Apple for $300 million, another to Cisco for $500 million. Microsoft bought a data privacy firm for a rumored $320 million. Facebook paid $150 million for a mobile analytics company. PayPal, $60 million, for a company that sees hacks coming before they happen. Even if the real purchase prices were half the rumored figure, they were still pretty good. Anything is possible. You can open any door if you just put your mind to it. The Israeli cyber specialists were the pride of a nation, a tiny country in the Middle East. Then Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu often boasted had made itself the equal of Russia, China, the United Kingdom, and the United States in high tech. Israel receives roughly 1/5 of the world's global private investment in cybersecurity, Netanyahu said in 2017. And given that we are 0.1% of the world's population, it means we're punching about 200 times above our weight. Not 2 times, not 10 times, and not even 100 times. 200 times above our weight. Which means there's something here that defies numerical size. How does a tiny nation carved from a desert become, within 70 years of its founding, one of the world's 5 cyber technology superpowers? Ask that question of anybody who got their cyber training in the Israeli military, from foot soldier to top commander, and they will tell you it all boils down to 2 things: vulnerability and need. The state of Israel was founded to secure for the Jewish people something they had been denied in modern history, a place of their own, where they could live by their own lights and thrive, beyond threat of the next pogrom or the next Holocaust. This has been one hell of a struggle, maddeningly enduring and often bloody, because Israel is an island surrounded by countries that don't really want it there. Governments in the neighborhood range from the cold and unfriendly to the hostile, to the irrational and hateful. A few have attempted to destroy the Jewish safe haven by force of arms. The continuing existence of Israel has depended on constant watchfulness, on identifying and shoring up their own points of weakness at any given moment, on the ability to anticipate where the next strike might happen. The attack could be armored batteries rolling into Israeli territory, or lone suicide bombers intent on murdering a few dozen private citizens in bars, restaurants, or bus stops. If the Israelis are not good, says a former technical director in the French intelligence services, they suffer. The Israelis understood this from the beginning, back when Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion was constructing the new country's defense doctrine in the late 1940s. Military intelligence, the ability to predict new threats and supply early warning, was a crucial pillar in Ben-Gurion's doctrine. This is the reason we need early warning, says Ehud Snorrison, a former commander in the IDF's elite intelligence unit. If we had tried to fund an army as big as our neighbors, we would have collapsed economically during the first 2 or 3 years, and I don't know how we could have survived. If you look at the Americans, intelligence is not as important, as you can see from the period from Pearl Harbor to Hiroshima. Americans are big enough that they can take a huge blow at the beginning of World War II, and they can, you know, kick your ass after 3 or 4 years. We don't have 3 or 4 years. We have 48 hours. This is the way we live. Intelligence is very important. That imperative was hardened and purified into something like steel after the Yom Kippur War in 1973, when Egypt and Syria launched a synchronized 2-prong offensive blitz that the IDF did not see coming. By the time Israel's under-resourced 7th Armored Brigade halted the Syrian tanks it advanced on the Golan Heights, and reinforcements helped push them back to the edge of Damascus and saved the state of Israel, according to Defense Minister Moshe Dayan, the IDF had determined they would never again suffer that kind of intelligence failure. Over the next 5 decades, Israel fed the best of its brain power into its elite military intelligence service, known as Unit 8200, to make sure there would be no repeat disaster. The top secret unit, its members were not allowed to speak its name or tell their closest family about their assignment, evolved with technology from analog to digital, from landline to cell phone, and always one step ahead. Innovation mattered above all in Unit 8200, and innovation could come from anywhere in the ranks. The Rosh Gadol who landed in 8200 weren't selected merely for their phenomenal test scores in math and physics. The scores were just the first filter. The potential intelligence ops were also screened for a certain suppleness of mind, a distrust of the common wisdom, and a willingness to challenge superiors. Debate was encouraged in 8200. ideas trumped rank. You are put into small teams where you study, brainstorm, train, analyze, solve problems from early in the morning to very late at night, an 8-200 veteran told a reporter from Forbes in 2016. It's not a passive approach to information. The cyber intelligence specialists in 8-200 worked long and hard, sometimes full 24 to 48 hour shifts during special operations. The young techs might spend their days and nights listening in on suspected terrorist cells, disabling an enemy's early warning system before an Israeli airstrike, helping to engineer the Stuxnet malware that crippled Iran's nuclear program, or providing eyes and ears, by remote, for a secret combat mission. A young cyber soldier could find herself on the phone with a curious cabinet minister, or an Israeli general, or a commander, whose troops were, at that very moment, in a life-and-death firefight. It's a hyper-stressed, hyper-worked technical environment where you have to make real choices, says one veteran of 8-200. Always under the gun to make decisions in time to be meaningful to somebody. Nobody tells you exactly what to do. They tell you, this is the problem, go figure it out, with a crazy deadline. So you're inventing, being entrepreneurial, and only understanding what you were doing after the fact. But you have to do it because you don't have any other choice to meet the mission you were given. I was 19, another ex-8200 soldier told the reporter from Forbes. All my friends in the States are doing their undergraduate work. You're doing that. By far, it was the period in my life where I had the most responsibility and the most impact to other people. You're also part of this secret thing, says another former member of Unit 8200. Sometimes you know about special operations or special abilities that nobody knows about outside, and you feel you're special and a part of this special ring. Maybe the Prime Minister of Israel and the Defense Minister and a few others know, but not a lot of others. So it's pretty big. In the few years after Apple set up its new R&D facility in the Promised Land and peopled it with the highly trained Rosh Gadol from Unit 8200, the Israeli cybersecurity industry boomed. The data was all there in the charts that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu liked to flash on the big screen every year during his speeches at CyberTech and Cyber Week in Tel Aviv. The number of cybersecurity firms in Israel had grown from 171 in 2013 to 420 in 2017. Private investments had sextupled in those same 4 years to more than $800 million. Team 8, a seed fund started by a former commander of 8200, was nearing the $100 million mark after new investments from Microsoft, Qualcomm, and Citi. The personal investment fund of Google executive chairman Eric Schmidt had been one of the first to kick money into that fund. So, Tim Cook and Apple were in the flood tide. Amazon, Google, and Microsoft had operations in Israel along with NEC and IBM and Cisco. We have special programs for a comfortable landing for companies that are coming here, Netanyahu explained. Netanyahu had become the chief proselytizer for the new industry, which gave him plenty chances to take credit as its chief visionary. The prime minister had taken a good look over the horizon and seen approaching danger. Israel had the stats on that too, from 20,000 cyber attacks per week to almost 700,000 in just 3 years. Which meant, as Netanyahu said, there is a tremendous business opportunity in the never-ending quest for security. His pitches to international audiences of government defense experts, cybersecurity specialists, and salivating private investors also gave Netanyahu plenty of chances to take credit as the lead architect of his country's biggest growth sector. The Netanyahu government had invested vast sums of money in our military intelligence, which goes to the army, the Mossad, Shin Bet, to other arms as well, the then prime minister told one cyber gathering in Tel Aviv. So we create an enormous number of knowledge workers, people who can deal with the internet, can deal with the ramifications of this revolution, both as workers and as entrepreneurs. And this is what we did in Israel. We took the sunk costs and created a business environment. The Netanyahu government was executing a list of do's and don'ts to create this environment, consistent with its long drive to convert Israel's controlled economy, not quite socialist, but semi-socialist, into an oasis of free market capitalism. because markets know better than politicians, Netanyahu would say, even prime ministers. The dues included tax breaks for cybersecurity entrepreneurs and their financial backers, and public investment. The Netanyahu government built a national security laboratory next to a major university campus. Be'er Sheva used to be known for camels and palm trees from the days of Abraham, Netanyahu says. Be'er Sheva means seven wells. Now there are wells of human creativity and cyber creativity. Everybody works together there in a small place. Government, academia, the private sector. The best young minds we have. Netanyahu's list of don'ts was much smaller. Only one, really. The first don't, he told the attendees of the CyberTech conference in Tel Aviv in January 2017, is don't overregulate. That one and only don't was a crucial driver of the constantly upward growth curve enjoyed by Israel's cyber industry. But NSO Group belonged to a small and sensitive subset of that industry, representing only about 5% of that sector, according to an estimate by the chief of Israel's National Cyber Directorate back in 2017, that needed close regulation. Most companies in Israel were marketing strictly defensive technologies that protected governments and businesses against cyber attack. NSO's signature technology, the Pegasus system, was engineered to invade and then take over a mobile phone in order to surveil the owner. This was a military-grade offensive weapon. Anybody who had seen stories about the terror attacks at Charlie Hebdo, or the Bataclan Theater in Paris, or a holiday party in San Bernardino, California, or a nightclub in Orlando, Florida, or the synagogue in Copenhagen cannot doubt the necessity or the value of cyber surveillance weapons like Pegasus. There were 7,000 people killed in more than 1,400 separate ISIS-led terror attacks around the world in 2016 alone. In Germany, Belgium, Turkey, Kazakhstan, Indonesia, Bangladesh, Pakistan, and Saudi Arabia, just to name a few. Disrupting terror attacks before they happened was the great hope at that moment, and tools like Pegasus were much sought. As a purveyor of these coveted offensive cyber weapons, NSO did have to operate within a regulatory regimen overseen by Israel's Ministry of Defense. The MOD required two separate licenses spelled out in the country's Defense Export Control Act. NSO and any other Israeli company selling these military-grade cyber weapons needed official permission just to talk to potential clients and official permission to provide the technology to an end user. The MOD restricted sales to government entities like law enforcement and national security agencies and, in theory, restricted the countries to which Pegasus could be exported. The restrictions had a lot of give in the joints in 2017. Pegasus and the like was a fairly new technology, so the government minders hadn't really caught on to the potential for abuse. Then, too, cyber surveillance enjoyed the don't overregulate ethic that protected the rest of the cybersecurity industry in Israel. The Netanyahu government, according to the head of its National Cyber Directorate, was there to clear the way for the private sector to do its thing. The only hard and fast rule written into the Defense Export Control Act was that these cyber surveillance systems cannot be sold to a country that was under an official United Nations Security Council arms embargo. This took North Korea, Lebanon, Libya, and a handful of African countries off the table. But the Israeli MOD had discretion to permit sales of the Pegasus system to any other foreign government, and the Prime Minister's office had the power to override any MOD denial. The bulk of NSO's MOD licenses at the time involved law enforcement clients in Europe, which, as one French national security professional explained to us, was gaining the reputation as the soft underbelly for potential terrorists. European law enforcement really needed this tool, and they were a relatively uncontroversial client base. These cops were almost always bound to seek court-approved warrants to use the spyware on an individual. The bulk of the company's revenue, however, came from big spending countries with dicey human rights records, most notably the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. The Israeli defense chieftains trusted NSO with sales to regimes like Saudi Arabia or the UAE or Morocco because they trusted NSO executives to abide by the one unwritten but inviolable rule. They kept their mouth shut about the identities of their end users. There was talk among the H200 alums that the company might be walking dangerously close to the ethical line. Many preferred to steer clear. A few even made it plain to recruiters at other companies that they didn't care to use their skills on anything but defense, true cybersecurity, and they wouldn't work for any company trafficking in spyware. But with Unit 8200 disgorging 1,000 or so hyper-trained cyber brains every year, Shalev Julio and Omri Lavi didn't have much trouble filling their growing ranks with capable young men and women. Shalev did have to work a little harder than most because he was an outsider among the Rosh Gadol, who don't have a lot of trust for outsiders to begin with. "He's like a very nice person, but it gives me a feeling of a car salesman," says one cybersecurity engineer Shalev tried to recruit. "Always has a big smile and talking and trying to sell you. He's a very friendly person, but every time I check a little bit deeper about something he said, nothing adds up." What Shalev and Omri did have going for them in corporate recruitment, even as outsiders, was that the stated values of NSO were not so different from Unit 8200's. "We're saving lives here." The work itself was challenging too, like the chance to go head-to-head with Apple's engineers, reputed to be the best and the best resourced in the cybersecurity business, and the chance to get the better of them. NSO became very good about 2017 and 2018, says a former commander of 8200, because the deals they had with the Gulf infused tons of money into the company, and because of working with the Europeans and against real targets, I think it matured their technology. If you were a young Rosh Gadol just entering the job market, the pay was a serious draw. And NSO hire right out of the army might see his salary jump from $2,500 a month to $25,000 overnight. Back in 2017, that was certainly enough to make it possible to ignore the sideways glances of the 8200 alums who stuck to the defense side of cyber, or to dismiss malicious talk around Herzliya. "They have the third tier of talent that we have in Israel," an executive at a successful startup in Tel Aviv would say. "These are the guys that don't have the right sense of smell. We have a saying in Hebrew that money always has a smell, and they don't smell the stinky smells of where that money came from." Whatever the talk among the world of 8200, Shalev and Omri and the rest of NSO must have taken heart in the support they got from the Israeli officialdom, like when Citizen Lab produced a series of reports toward the end of 2017 about the abuses of Pegasus technology in Mexico. Researchers in Toronto had documented Pegasus spyware attacks against about 20 people there, including reporters, human rights lawyers, opposition politicians, and even the outspoken parents of one of the student teachers taken off the bus and murdered by a drug cartel in Ayotzinapa. When Shalev and Omri refused to speak to any specific charges, but suggested instead a nefarious anti-Semitic plot afoot within Citizen Lab, Israeli government apparatchiks joined the chorus singing cabal and conspiracy. "I can tell you that's for sure that we see the fingerprints and footprints of anti-Israel and even anti-Semitic elements at Citizen Lab," says one of Netanyahu's key advisors from the time, without adducing a whit of evidence. The Citizen Lab reports did prompt a legal petition in Israel to forbid the sales of Pegasus to governments that regularly violated human rights, but the petition was waved away. The Supreme Court in Israel refused to interfere with MOD decision-making, or to air the suit in public, or to even release the full text of the judgment to the public. The judges agreed with the Netanyahu government that the details of the cyber weapons license needed to be kept under seal. "Our economy, as it happens, rests not a little on that export," Supreme Court President Justice Esther Hayut had once said. The protection afforded by this government-wrought cloak of secrecy had swelled Shalev's confidence to something approaching impunity by 2018. The sense of invincibility was hard to miss in the aftermath of the violent assassination of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who was a contributing columnist for the Washington Post. News of the shocking murder of this occasional critic of the Saudi royal family made headlines around the world in October 2018. Khashoggi had been lured to the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey, where a team of 15 men killed him, sawed him into bits, and disposed of the body. The CIA's official assessment was that the operation was authorized by Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. The kill team, according to the CIA report, included 7 members of the Rapid Intervention Force, MBS's personal protective detail. The RIF exists to defend the Crown Prince, answers only to him, and had directly participated in earlier dissident suppression operations in the kingdom and abroad at the Crown Prince's direction. We judge that members of the RIF would not have participated in the operation against Khashoggi without Mohammed bin Salman's approval. The NSO spyware was also implicated in the Saudis' latest dissident suppression operation. Pegasus had reportedly been used by the kingdom to track Khashoggi and a number of people in his circle. One of them had filed his own lawsuit against NSO in Tel Aviv. Shalev, who was then in the middle of a deal with another private equity firm to restructure the company and pump some more cash into its operation, went on a publicity campaign to defend NSO and its hundreds of dedicated employees. This campaign culminated in a one-on-one interview with Leslie Stahl of 60 Minutes in March 2019. It's been reported that you yourself went to Riyadh in Saudi Arabia. You yourself sold Pegasus to the Saudis for $55 million. Stahl told Shalev near the top of the broadcast interview. Shalev just grinned. "Don't believe newspapers," he said. "Is that a denial?" Stahl pressed. Shalev remained silent, still grinning. "No," Stahl said. Shalev more than held his own after that, though, crediting Pegasus with saving tens of thousands of lives. He claimed that he knew of only 3 real cases of misuse in the 8 years of NSO's existence. Out of thousands of cases of saving lives, 3 was a misuse. And those people, or those organizations that misuse the system, they are no longer a customer, and they will never be a customer again. On the question of the alleged cyber surveillance of Jamal Khashoggi and his close friends and relatives, Shalev was direct and unequivocal. "The Khashoggi murder is horrible, really horrible," he said. "And therefore, when I first heard their accusations that our technology had been used on Jamal Khashoggi or on his relatives, I started an immediate check about it. And I can tell you very clearly, we had nothing to do with this horrible murder. I can tell you that we've checked, and we have a lot of ways to check. And I can guarantee you, our technology was not used on Jamal Khashoggi or his relatives."